I'd like to welcome you to the latest in this session's seminars for the Institute of Applied Ethics. Many familiar faces, you know the sort of areas that we normally tend to cover. Many of them deal with inequality and injustice of various types, and it's for that reason especially pleasing that Professor Danny Dorling has agreed to come and speak to us. Professor Dorling is the Holford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. He is, of course, well known for a great many books and journalistic interventions and papers. He is a cartographer as well as a social critic, and one of the most important commentators on the left in this country at the moment. Many academics aspire to be public intellectuals and credible scholars. Very few of them manage it. One thing we can say is that Danny Dorling definitely achieves both. You've come to hear him, not me, so on that I will just pass over to Professor Dorling.
Thank you. Thank you ever so much for coming. I'm going to start off in a slightly odd way. I'm going to play you a little music video with some pictures. It takes about 4 minutes, and the reason for playing this is these are images that are in the book that my friends Sally and I have written about Brexit, so I'm not just making all this up. For the last 2 years I've been worrying about Brexit and what does it mean and what does it tell us about the British. So I'm going to show you the images, play some music, and it kind of gives you an idea of the prejudices you're about to hear, at least, before I explain any more about why I'm interested. So if you don't like the rest, at least you get Aztec camera.
Yeah.
Brexit is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. More fascinating than anything I think that's happened in terms of politics and social science since the Second World War. I've been trying to work out how many times bigger this is than Suez. And I finally today worked out a metric. I'm going to measure how much the pound fell from the start to the end of the Suez crisis. Compare it to the pound falling from the start of Brexit through to now. And then the multiple I get, I'll better say six times bigger than Suez or whatever it is. Brexit is also fascinating because of how absolutely unanticipated I think it was. If you take another event, take the banking crash of 2008, quite a few academics had written books and papers saying that the system wasn't working, there's going to be a crash and so on. It's always worth doing that, by the way. Just, you know, write something saying everything's going to fall apart. You could be lucky, and then you can say. That was a bit predictable. Most people didn't predict it, but some did. Lots of people say they saw this coming, but for some reason they didn't write about it beforehand. Now, if any of you can find me somebody who actually, say 2 years before the event, you know, said this is what's going to occur and this is why, I would be fascinated. Sally Tomlinson is my co-author on this book. Sally and I have not managed to find anybody who actually predicted it in any way. It's easy to feel after the event that you knew. It's easy to tell yourself a story that you kind of knew, but it wasn't, no. Sally, before I don't say anything else about Sally, Sally's great. Sally's impetus was, she was a primary school teacher in Wolverhampton at the time that Enoch Powell gave that speech. And she hasn't liked Enoch Powell ever since. And if you know about Enoch and what Enoch believed about Britain, yeah, you've got an idea why. This is a summary of what I'm going to argue with you today. If I manage not to lose the mic. So this is my particular take. Before I go any further, I should say I did this talk a couple of weeks ago in London, and a professor from Cambridge asked the first question. And the first question wasn't really a question. The first question was a 4-minute rant about how could I be so flippant and condescending. So I just want to let you know I'm not trying to be flippant and condescending. What's happening is very, very serious, but we do have to laugh at it at various points, otherwise the next year is going to get very, very dire over things. Why didn't anybody really see it coming? We'd learnt to believe the spread betters. We'd actually learnt, for people who study elections, we very quietly learnt that the spread betting tells you what's going to happen, because the spread betting kept on getting election after election right before it. And the spread betting before Brexit was that Remain were going to win. And then Joe Cox was murdered. And then you thought, well, that's it. And it wasn't just people like me that thought that was it. Quite clearly, when you look at their faces the morning after, Boris Johnson and Michael Gove didn't expect to win. In fact, when you look at it in hindsight, the Brexit campaign wasn't ready to win. They were supposed to lose the first referendum and get a second. But I'm going to rattle on, otherwise I can go on forever. The other thing to say is that, of course, we don't know the motivations of people in terms of how they voted. The only thing we know for certain is who voted and where they lived. And that alone is fascinating, and how we haven't looked at that. We can't actually know the motivations of people who voted. There's lots of surveys, we've got lots of guesses. My personal favourite is immigration was absolutely key. Fear of immigration was key, but of course I can't prove that. What I can prove is where the people were. Secondly, hostility to the EU, when you look at it over time, there wasn't a steady rise in hostility to the EU. It was whipped up. It was whipped up in particular places. It was whipped up before particular European elections. And when you surveyed the population after European elections, suddenly they didn't care about Europe. So I'm going to claim the population has been in many ways manipulated by people who think it is really, really important that we leave the EU. It is not a process where the British people have come to this idea themselves. Thirdly, the demographics have been distorted in the most remarkable way by the press. Partly because when they started to tell the story on referendum night, you got to remember the press themselves were in shock as things didn't begin to go the way they'd expected. They settled on old tropes. One blonde woman and a couple of men in Sunderland. And, you know, that was great for kind of sticking it on that. And if you had the desire, you could go through the referendum night coverage and actually see which places they decided to report from, which they didn't. But then the question is afterwards, why do we carry on telling a story of places like Hull, and places like Sunderland, places like Great Yarmouth, places like Merthyr Tydfil, and not of the places that actually provided the vast majority of Leave voters? And a trite and kind of slightly flippant argument is because the places that supplied the majority of Leave voters are where the parents of BBC journalists live, right? It's the outer home counties. And actually admitting that you come from Leave Central is quite tricky when you live in the Remain Central, which is central London. Here's probably my greatest bias. I've been looking at inequality for 30 years. I think inequality was incredibly important. The UK is the most unequal country in all of Europe by income. That's undisputed. 30-odd countries in Europe, it's quite hard to be at the top of a league table of 30 countries, particularly if you're a large country. It takes a lot of effort to become the most economically unequal country, but we managed to do it. I don't think it's a coincidence that a country like that was the second country to vote out. This attests, who knows the first country to leave the European community?
Greenland.
Greenland. Well, this is the first time somebody's got it right. We talk, congratulations. Greenland was the first, left the community. They spent 3 years negotiating because they had 56,000 people and it was important. And they also spent 3 years negotiating because they had something worth negotiating over, which was fish. And they got a good deal. And we're going to find out all kinds of things about ourselves now. They also managed to keep citizenship through Denmark. And in fact, even now, the European community subsidises children in Greenland their education by €500 a year. It's a really good deal. Can you imagine that? You know, we're going to leave, but we'll carry on the right to go and work in Europe if we want to, and we'll ask them for some money. But underneath all this is empire, the British Empire. Underneath, why did we become the most unequal country in Europe? Why are we so very odd? What is different to us? Unlike any other country in Europe, 100 years ago, we were the richest place on the planet. And that has consequences. Consequences, it turns out, are longer lasting than we may have thought. And then lastly, in hindsight, given what could have happened, and given what has happened and what we now know, 52-48 was pretty perfect. And here you may well disagree with me. But swap it around. Make it 52% remain, 48% leave. Can you imagine what would have happened? Would anybody have investigated Cambridge Analytica? Would Aaron Banks be being investigated by the police? Would we have got to the bottom of lots of things that have gone on? Would the Leavers have just said, oh, fair enough, you know, 52%, 48, that's it. You know, of course we're going to be European from now on. If it had been the other way round, short of a 66% Remain majority, we'd be facing another referendum. It would have carried on. Were people that said, oh, immigrants, I love them now. That's great. They don't cause any problems in Britain. You know, 52% have voted Remain. I was wrong. You know, it would have gone on and on. It could have gone on for a decade or more. It would have been absolutely awful. The attempts to leave would have carried on. Yeah, we'd have had a change. Boris could have made it to Prime Minister. You know, he didn't really want to leave. He really, really, really wanted to be Prime Minister. You know, so the idea was he would be there for, you know, battling the bus, doing all of this, looking after the working man, doing other things for the women. And the book has been read for libel. And, you know, he'd become Prime Minister and then, you know, we'd leave and it wouldn't really matter what happened because he would achieve his achievement. That's just one person in the many people involved in this. I've got some graphs. You'll be glad to know this talk is now cut down from 40 slides to 22. It should get shorter and shorter throughout next year. Immigration. The graph to your top left is the kind of graph that we don't produce in Britain that they produce in America. It's a graph that goes from 1841, the first time we counted where people were born and living in this country, through to, I think, 2011. It goes up to 8 million people. It shows the kind of rise in immigration over time. The big source of immigration in the past was Ireland. And then you see various accelerations from the pogroms in Russia. And we really wanted to stop the Jews coming in. That's when the British Union of Fascists began. Through to Windrush, and we got very worried about that. That was terrible. Making the schools not work, taking the houses, taking the jobs. It's the same story again and again. Through to A8, most recently. The graph directly below is the same data, but if you put everybody born in Britain in, it's a bit less dramatic. And I'm going to argue that immigration isn't a problem. Immigration is very, very good news. And I've felt more and more strongly over this over the last 2 years as I've gone through it. The graph of all the lines should really have taken it back much further. I was involved in looking at elections in 2001, 2005. And in those years, the most salient issue when you ask voters what mattered to them the most was immigration. And being political scientists, we're kind of a bit embarrassed about this. We didn't write about it very much. But immigration was the key. It's the green line with the strange kind of world thing. The key thing until the largest economic crash since 1929 occurred. And that's what it took for the economy to become a more important issue than immigration for a time. And then immigration rises back up just before the referendum to be the most important economic issue. And then bang, you vote to leave. Thankfully, nobody's worrying too much about immigration again. I wouldn't put it past people, with whatever happens over the next few months, to start blaming immigrants for not coming or something. I really wouldn't put it past us. And then if you look towards the end, you see the NHS manages to rear its head. And actually, I'll tell you more about that later, but there is a good reason why we do worry about the NHS at the moment. And finally, the European community actually becomes the most salient issue at the moment. The map, finally, is a map which is coloured in. These are hexagons of parliamentary constituencies. They're cut in half. They're shaded by the most common and second most common ethnicity of young adults, which are the most diverse group. Areas coloured light blue. The most common group is white. Who's white in the room? Can you put your hands up if you're white? If you tick white. Okay, and the second most common group are other white. So who ticks an other kind of white? Oh, you're there we go, one other white. If you're in the South, loads of us, we're all kind of ever so exotic forms of white in the South. Anyway, the light blue is white and other white. We're a bloody white country. You know, that's the reason. One more of these maps. This is a cartogram, it's stretched, it's Europe. I'm afraid I've been drawing these for 3 decades now, so I get blasé and I'm used to them. How many of you have not seen a map like this before? Go on, be honest. Okay, enough to worth explaining. It's stretched so that everybody gets the same amount of space on the map. We've got rid of all the mountains, rural areas are squeezed, the cities are made big. Everywhere has the same population density. So you're getting, if you like, a view where you're looking at people correctly. You can see Turkey down the bottom, and Istanbul is the big circle. Biggest city in Europe, coming in. And the shading is by proportion of people born overseas. European data, 2014. The yellow is less than 5%. Almost no immigrants. Most of Eastern Europe, despite immigration from further east, is yellow. Quite a lot of mainland Europe is yellow, but not that much. But most of the UK is yellow. The immigrants are not here. They didn't come here. They didn't come to Hull. Some came to Boston. There was a few, but compared to the normal rate of immigration in Europe, it's not high. 95% of people in an area like this born in the UK. The immigrants came to London, because of course you would. Yeah, because that's where the high paid jobs are. And if you're going to turn up in a country that you don't know, and you're willing to do, you know, pretty hard work for money, you're going to want to be paid more money than somewhere else. So London, in fact, West Inner London, is the only area of Britain where over 20% of the people were born overseas. I'll show you later the map of the voting, but the map of immigration is almost the opposite of the map of the voting. The more immigrants in an area, the more people voted Remain. The immigrants were not allowed to vote. You had to be a British citizen to be allowed to vote. So it wasn't that the immigrants were voting. It's the fewer immigrants that there are in your area, the more scared you are about immigrants on average. The easier it is to scare you about immigrants and the effects of immigration. Ireland, as you'll see, is darker shades of blue. Because there are two separate countries in Ireland and people have crossed over that non-existent border. We've learnt an amazing amount since the 23rd of June 2016. You put a yoghurt pot on that border and you're in trouble, right? Because we made an agreement that it wasn't there anymore. An agreement that was really, really important to people who we didn't care about very much, who we're going to have to care about now. High rates of immigration in most of the mainland, but you don't see them leaving. The highest rates in Switzerland, it's partly the shape of Switzerland, because you know it's kind of long and thin, it's got mountains. But the other block of really high immigration is Spain, particularly along the Mediterranean coast. But they're not immigrants, they're expats. And you're going to be meeting some of them soon. The ones you're going to meet first, get out the bunting, the ones you'll meet first are the ones who are most ill. And of course we've got the NHS all just geared up and ready for them to come back to. And it's not so much the people coming back, because actually they'll desperately try to stay there if they can. The real problem is that the continuous stream of sending people out is going to stop. David Cameron's dad died in France. Nick Clegg's dad died in France. The mainland has served a very useful purpose to us of sending our elderly out. We had this incredible deal. The incredible deal wasn't just that we actually weren't paying our fair share. We had a deal under Margaret Thatcher that we actually don't pay the same as other people, we pay less. But we, more than any other country, were shipping our elderly, not just to Spain, but to Greece and to Cyprus and to Malta and to France. And not just were we shipping our elderly out and using their health services, we were shipping in millions of their best educated, young, fittest, most keen people, squeezing them into tiny flats in London and Oxford and places, and getting them to do the jobs that we didn't want to do for really low wages, after somebody else had educated them to often have two university degrees from their own country that we hadn't paid for the education of. In terms of throwing something away, it is utterly, utterly remarkable. So, you see too many graphs, but they're just there to say, I'm not making this up. I'll describe them, you don't have to read them. The rise of the far right. Rise of the far right in Britain. When we talk about the far right, you immediately think about mainland Europe, and you think of places like Austria, and people in Sweden and so on, or Le Pen in France. That's not where the far right rose the most. Way back in 1994, the National Front managed to get about 1% of the vote in the European election 1994. In the European election 5 years earlier, they got 0.1%. We had almost no far-right voting in European elections at the start of this. By 1999, it's risen again. By 2004, we got UKIP doing okay. By 2009, we're looking between a third and a quarter of the European vote. You've got to remember, turnout's quite low. But a third to a quarter of the vote for far-right parties at the European elections. Now, 2009 was really interesting because the British Conservatives left the main European bloc in the Parliament, the EPP. And shortly after that, they created their own group to the right of the main European Conservatives. Now, I have a very simple definition of far-right. It is to the right of mainstream Conservatives. And by 2014, 51.9% of people who voted in the European election in this country, 51.9, voted for a party that was to the right of the mainstream European Conservatives. We sent more far-right MEPs, Nigel Farage, Daniel Hammond and so on, to Brussels than any other country. The far-right in Europe is bolstered and held up by British MEPs, right of the mainstream European Conservatives. We don't think of ourselves as a far-right country, we think of ourselves as normal. Everybody thinks of themselves as normal until they come and cart you away. You know, you adjust like the frog in the kettle. And nobody, I didn't notice this, nobody looked at the 2014 election and said 51.9% of people have voted for a party to the right of mainstream European Conservatives. Nowhere else in Europe have they done that. You know, a couple of people in Finland, one in Sweden, a few in Austria. Not the majority. In hindsight, it was incredible. The swirly graph in a minute, I'll show you another swirly graph later, so I won't explain it, but kind of trust me, I've drawn lots of these swirly graphs. It's taking out the Conservatives, it's the rising support for BNP, National Front, UKIP and so on. I put them together. It might upset somebody, but I grew up in the 1970s, so that's why I put them together. And the swirling and the rising is the rising support at each European election. This is what I mean. It's not a steady increase. It suddenly zooms up and then support collapses until there's the next election. It goes down again straight afterwards. Begins in 1997 with Jimmy Goldsmith when he paid for a video cassette. Can anybody remember getting it? Every household in Britain was sent, I think it was VHS, not Betamax. You're too young. Every household was sent a video cassette about how terrible the European Union was by James Goldsmith, who really didn't like it. And he paid the deposits for candidates to stand all over the country and got just over 1% of the vote. And that's the beginning, the kind of precursor of the modern UKIP. Of course, UKIP now have absolutely collapsed again because they've kind of served their purpose. And the last graph nearer to me is the swings in more recent years in popularity of Leave and Remain. The Conservatives stuck the promise in their manifesto for 2015. They didn't expect to get a working majority in 2015. That's why they put the promise of a referendum in the manifesto. They thought they'd be there with Liberals again, they wouldn't have to do it. Then shock. For the first time since 1992, really for the first time since UKIP got big, the Conservatives got themselves a majority on their own. Committed to a referendum, but also with this running sore in the party since the 90s. And lucky Dave Cameron, who'd always been lucky, and everything has always gone right for him, thought, I'll do it again. I'll go for a punt. He picked it at a point when Remain was very high in the polls, and called a referendum with the support of the trade unions, the CBI, the church, the BBC, the academics, every member of anything you could even think of establishment and things that were not establishment on his side, versus a small group of people in his party, and he thought he would get it, and didn't. So why? Age. Lots been said about age. One of the really important things about the vote is turnout. Turnout is as important as who votes Leave and who votes Remain. So here you see for different age groups the proportion voting Remain and Leave and not bothering to vote. The young, by the way, I should say, are not lazy. We taught the young in 1991 not to vote. We taught them by introducing the poll tax. It was immediately after the poll tax that turnout amongst the very young collapsed. If you basically fine people for existing, there is a great incentive to go off the electoral roll. The age groups that most supported Remain, 35 to 44, actually turning out and voting. Right. The young are very, very excited about Remain, but much more excited about not voting. The good news is that this was the last time the young stopped voting. They voted at the general election the year after like anything. It kind of taught, if you really want to educate a generation about why it matters to vote, it was a kind of a good way to do it. But of course the big thing is the rising red over time. Right, the older you are, the more likely you are to vote Leave. So why? Why did old people vote Leave? Now, it wasn't selfish. I don't think it was selfish. Go on.
It's because they knew that the country before joining the EU was better off.
Yes. Yes. You've preempted me. Or they thought, well, they knew it was better off. It was relatively better off. And they didn't know why to become worse off. The graph nearer me is the dollar to the pound over a century. When my granddad was born near Murfield, $5 to the pound. When my mum was born in Leeds, I think, $4 to the pound. I was born in Oxford, $3 to the pound. When my oldest child was born, $2 to the pound. We're heading towards a dollar to the pound. I don't know, it depends how it goes on the 11th of December, whether we manage to hit that kind of thing. Dramatic fall over time. I went abroad for the first time at age 15 with school on a trip to France. I got 10 francs for every pound. You could buy a bottle of wine for 3 francs. I mean, honestly, 10 francs to the pound. This summer in Gatwick, I think it was £1.11 for a euro, if you were silly enough to buy it at the airport. We were kings. We were kings, and it wasn't just that economically we were so much better off than people on the mainland. We taught people in their school textbooks about how great Britain was, how we invented everything. Steam engines, spinning jennies, all of it. We made it all. And that's why we were so rich. We didn't mention some other things. Right, let's put it like that. You can't, the nice thing about Brexit is you're slowly learning about the other things. Is this the Wilberforce building? Yeah. So lots about Wilberforce, quite a few museums about the ending of slavery. We don't teach much about the start of modern slavery, or which country was it that was most involved in moving millions of people from one continent to another. Just like we don't have a museum about immigration. We think it's ever so good that we passed a law to end slavery with lots of compensation for people like Cameron's forebears. But we don't mention that. We don't mention that the cotton came back over and why the cotton was bought by all these people around the world. I mean, couldn't they have spun the cotton in their own countries? If you go to New Zealand today and you go to a supermarket and you're looking down the aisles, you'll see the word Manchester. And the word Manchester in a supermarket in New Zealand means linen. What on earth are we doing shipping linen all the way as far as you can around the planet? And did New Zealand carry on buying the linen from Manchester after New Zealand managed to get a choice over where it got its linen from? We don't talk about that. We don't talk about how we grew opiates, poppies in India, and sent our battleships to China to force them to buy it. Every child in China knows what we did. They're all taught that we were the biggest drug dealer in the world and we destroyed civilization in China by flooding the country with drugs. But of course we don't talk that in our textbooks. And the older you are, the less you are told. And I won't go through what we've gone through textbooks. The textbooks people were taught who are in their 70s now and their 60s and their 50s. But it is quite incredible, theories of racial superiority actually being taught to school children. And I think that plays a part. If you're brought up with an idea that your country is so special and you watch it collapse around you relatively, you watch a situation in which your children are having to pay rent because they can't get a mortgage, and you don't know what's going to happen to your grandchildren, then for the future you vote Leave to make things better. Because they were better and you were told that this country was special. It's obviously more complicated than that, and we obviously want to get to questions, so I won't go on about it, but the one other thing to say is there's one particular group who were really told that we were special. And they are boys in the public school in the past. The public schools, why do we have public schools when other European countries didn't as much? What was the purpose of Eton and Harrow? Yeah, to lead, stiff upper lip, lead men, control whole countries, take the Khyber Pass and hold it with 12 people. We created the education system in this country to run the biggest empire the world has ever known, and that requires installing certain beliefs and confidence. We have a university system, a hierarchical university system designed to run an empire, which makes it a little bit embarrassing now trying to keep the whole thing going, and saying what you do. And when you look at who was most in favour of leaving an empire 2.0, not only were they disproportionately from some of these schools, a remarkable number of the older ones actually grew up in a former colony and had black servants as children. The best writing on Brexit that I have seen has been by black journalists in Britain in the last 2 years. And Irish journalists. Here's the map of the result. It's a remarkable map. The far map is just what's the majority. Yellows remain. Blue, most of the country is Leave. The nearer map to me shows kind of shades of subtlety over that. And in case you can't work out areas in your head that quickly, the majority of the Leave vote was in the south of England. The majority of Leave voters from surveys were social class A, B, C, 1. They were old, disaffected, middle England, conservative voters in the south. But nobody showed a picture of those on referendum night. Nobody went down to Hampshire and said, you know, here it is. Just to give you an idea, I won't read it out because I don't want to run out of time. For every county now in the south of England, I've constructed an opposite county in the north. And I've constructed it out of a whole load of districts in the north which all voted Leave and which have a bigger electorate than that county. And in each case, more people voted Leave in somewhere like Essex than that list of 22 put together. I did the next one, Hampshire. You've probably never heard of Hampshire as Leave Central, right? You don't think of Hampshire. Hampshire has a smaller electorate than the combined areas of Bolsover, Doncaster, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent and Sunderland. Fewer voters. But more people voted Leave in Hampshire than all those areas put together. And have you ever heard of anybody saying it was Hampshire? But you've heard of people saying it was Hull and Stoke and Sunderland. And that's what I mean. The one thing I think I could be certain of, because we know where people were and we know the votes by area, is we've actually misinterpreted the bloody vote. You know, and it's been 2 years. And we still don't actually know about the vote. Kent. More people vote Leave in Kent. Derby, Blackpool, Rotherham, Sheffield, the fifth largest city of Britain. Great Yarmouth, Hartlepool and Merthyr. You've heard loads about Merthyr Tydfil. How could they vote out in Merthyr Tydfil? Don't they know what they're getting? Right? Well, doesn't Kent know what it's getting? I mean, Kent relies a little bit more on, you know, not being a lorry park for the next 10 years. Wales, the one country in the region of the whole of the UK that voted spot on the UK average, was Wales. Wales was the most boring average place in a referendum. Does anybody ever tell you that? No. They tell you, well, we can't understand why the Welsh voted out. They just voted average. I mean, you can look at the average, and it's an interesting average. The Welsh speaking areas were more of a main, and they were cancelled out by the areas where the English immigrants from the Midlands have come and settled. Okay, and there's a story about Wales and that. And I try not to get more riled. But it just annoys me because it's so simple. A geography undergraduate could do this. No regression models, no complicated techniques, just some adding ups of some numbers. Forgetting about writing bloody documents, 585 pages, which incidentally only have 115 words on the entire finance industry. That's two lines. Right? Barclays shares are now down 40% to what they were on the 23rd of June 2016. 7 of that percentage drop happened in the last 2 weeks. Lloyd's is less than half. Without passporting, I don't think our banks are viable. Or put it another way, you might think they might be viable without passporting, but for the stress test, they rely on the value of housing because that's the collateral behind the banks. Anyway, it's going to be fun. The important thing is to sit together, be nice to each other, and queue. I'll tell you about the complicated graph first. The complicated graph, these are all the constituencies of England. They're sorted into 10 groups, from the poorest tenth to the richest tenth of constituencies, the richest tenth and nearest me. This was drawn by Daniel Watts, and I'd love to meet Daniel Watts. Daniel Watts was an unemployed man in a house in Newcastle who put this graph up on the web first. Not an academic, not an expert, he just did it as a hobby. And what does it show? The blue areas of Remain, dark blue is strong Remain, light blue is weaker Remain. Strongest Remain is in the posh parts of Britain. Posh London, posh Oxford, posh Cambridge, posh parts of Bristol, posher parts of Manchester and Liverpool. The places where you might go skiing twice in winter, right? You really don't want to have to get a visa and so on. Places where you might have a cleaner who probably wasn't born in England, that kind of. So, but what's really interesting about the graph is that the strongest leave, which is the red and the pink, are the middle four deciles. Middle England. Middle England voted out. Actually weaker in the poorest third. There are two correlations. I haven't got time to talk about Dominic Cummings or Boris, but we can talk about them later if you wish. I now know, because the book's been read for legal, what I can say and what I can't say to libel them. The correlation between deprivation and the leave vote was 0.03. That means nothing. No relationship between deprivation and the leave vote. 0.03. The top correlation, which is actually fractionally bigger than the correlation with immigration, and the strongest correlation ever found with the leave vote so far, is with obesity. At 0.8. 0.8 is incredibly strong. Now, the person who found it was very excited 3 weeks after the vote and published straight away, which, if you want to get vilified as an academic, I've forgotten, I think it's the Sun, the Daily Express and the Daily Mail all tore him apart about how can you say fat people vote leave. He did, but it's interesting. 0.8 is really strong. If you want to guess as to why there's such a strong correlation between obesity and voting leave, 2 years ago I was thin, but for the purposes of scientific study I've been eating. And I've now got myself to the kind of average weight in the leave area. No, it's not. Silly arguments are put forward that says that fatter people are more feckless and, you know, no. There's an amazing geography of fatness and thinness in Britain. We, along with Hungary, are the fattest part of Europe. It's connected with inequality, we can go on about it. But the thing which makes an area thin, currently more than anything else, are immigrants. Because they're coming from thinner countries, and they're not just coming from thinner countries, they're young, and they're the most able, fittest, healthiest, educated people from those countries. So believe me, we've got lots of immigrants in Oxford. In Oxford, I am quite large. In Hull, I'm a bit more average. I did go for a walk outside the station, and I was with my people. I felt happy. I won't stretch it too far, but there's been lots of work about obesity that says it's easier to get fatter if there are fatter people around you because you don't feel fat. Right, so it's not fatness causing the Leave vote, it's the areas with high immigration are where life's winners end up and they tend to be thinner. If you go for job interviews, you've all got very similar qualifications, you've been shortlisted, what do you think they pick you on? They pick you on how pretty your face is and how you look. That's why Oxford University should stop doing interviews for admissions. Every October, I wonder, weren't there some really, really clever fat 18-year-olds? Anyway, I don't like interviews at all. Inequality, you probably know we were very unequal. By the 1970s, we were actually the second most equal country, large country in Europe to Sweden. The early 1970s were wonderful. I was there. It was great. You can make an argument for not joining the European community then. We could actually say we were actually doing okay. Most of Europe was more unequal. Capitalist club, why would you want to join? And then we managed to increase our inequality so that by now the best off 10%. Let's do it. Who's in the best off 10%? Oh, none of you. Come on. Go on. You ought to know what it is. So you don't even know the threshold. Should we do the threshold? Family income of over about 45,000 a year. Two of you. Joint income over 45,000. I know you can never do this in England, can you? Yeah. Well, there we go. Okay. Bit for that. The rest of you can mug us later. We, the 10%, are taking 40% of everything every year. And we're leaving the other 90% of you 60%. That's the kind of inequality we have now. International League Table of Inequality for OECD countries. They're all basket cases. The unequal countries are basket cases. Most of the OECD is remarkably equal. The most equal people have been almost in human history. In places like Finland and Norway, Germany and Japan. It's an amazing success story. But here's the loser list. And you've got to remember there are actually another sort of 50 countries underneath that bottom table. Mexico. Things aren't going that well in Mexico. Chile. The only OECD country to spend more on private education than we do. Turkey. If you've any idea about what's going on in Turkey, you'll know it's not necessarily good. United States. Say the same. Lithuania, the Baltic countries are interesting, I won't say any more, they're very small. Russia, not in a great state, really. And right next to Russia is the United Kingdom. And a country which is slightly more equal, where people care about each other a little bit more than the United Kingdom, is Israel, including the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. If you want to get an idea of our social divisions, we have wider income inequalities than Israel, including the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. These countries are all in some way politically failing. There are lots and lots of effects of inequality. They're often indirect. It isn't that inequality directly causes this. This is my favourite one, which is inequality in ability in maths. In the most unequal rich countries, the USA, UK, people are remarkably bad at maths. If we had time, we'd just do a quick maths test. Right, because you dubbed that. This is a public lecture at a university. The people who come to public lectures at university tended to score over average at maths tests. But you'd all be a bit worried about taking the maths test you took at 16 now. If you've gone to school in Finland or the Netherlands or South Korea, and we test you later on, people can still do maths. So what's happening in the UK? What's happening in the UK, because it's a very unequal country, is that what really matters is getting an A star or an A or a C. And we teach children to get that at 16, and we teach them it in such a way that they really hate maths and they don't learn it. And they do even worse in the United States, because the exam results really matter, because they determine whether you might be in that 10%, taking 40% of everything and going skiing twice a year, or whether you're near the bottom. So social mobility is really low in the UK and the USA because the gaps are so wide. Countries in which people don't understand that not everybody can get in the top 10% are countries where people are worse at maths. I'm going to flip through all the rest of it to get through in 5 minutes because I'm most interested in your questions. We had real wage falls equivalent of Greece. Our austerity and our fall in our standard of living has been as bad as Greece. But we don't think a bit about that and you say, oh no, I've seen pictures of Greece, it was really, really bad. And it was bad, but it's just as bad here. I used to take a field trip of geography students every year to Athens. Normally field trips are a complete waste of time, it's a party, they get drunk, they can't get arrested, it's really embarrassing, and it's exhausting. After the financial crash, geography students from the University of Sheffield where I worked, the 8 days they spent in Athens, they learnt more than 3 years at the university. Because walking into a country that's fallen apart is an absolute education. But then to understand that many parts of this country are actually worse. And if you don't believe me about worse, people have a higher life expectancy in Greece. Babies have a higher chance of surviving to age one in Greece than in the UK. This little graph nearer to me was in the Financial Times, 2015. We were the only country where when GDP rose, we still let wages fall. For that to happen, the people running companies have to be taking all the extra growth and a bit more. Right? The other countries, Italy, Portugal and Greece, GDP falls, wages fall. And in a whole block of countries, GDP rises, wages rise. And in some particularly advanced places, Denmark, Latvia, Slovenia, Spain, Finland, even though GDP fell, they still increased wages. That's kind of nice, you can do that. We don't believe it. But in the UK, even when we got economic recovery, we still allowed average wages to drop. If you were trying to piss the population off, you really couldn't have gone about it. Empire. That's a particular map of the British Empire, drawn using current populations. The kind of trite and flippant thing I'm tempted to say is, if other countries in the Commonwealth took the Commonwealth really seriously, they would have selected the next head of the Commonwealth from India. But because they don't take the Commonwealth that seriously, they didn't select the next head of the Commonwealth from India. Let's just put it like that. We tell ourselves all kinds of myths about the empire, about how wonderful and civilizing it was. And the last colony to go was Hong Kong in 1997, and the image of Hong Kong was the Chancellor of my university, Chris Patton, wiping away the tear from his daughter's eye as the flag was pulled down for the last time and the Royal Yacht Britannia flew out. You can't see Prince Charles is just by the side of that, looking bemused, not knowing what to do. We've got him in the book. Why was she crying? Shall I?
Because she'd lived there and she was leaving the home.
Yes, sort of. She actually cried for 3 hours. She said in a newspaper article why she cried. She just got together with Alex, the surfer. And she'd been with Alex, the boyfriend, for not very long and she had to leave and it's all about Alex. But we presented it as a story about empire. I mean, you are partly right, it is about leaving home. But, you know, we wanted to present the last colony going as a bad thing for the world because the British Empire had done such wonderful things. Remember, this was the entry gateway for the biggest flooding of opiates to destroy one of the world's longest established civilizations. People move around. This is just a map of human migration over a very long time. I made the point. People move around. The biggest immigrant group in this country are the English who've retired to Wales. They don't learn the language. They buy the nicer houses. I could go on about it, but you know, if you want to get annoyed about immigrants, I would start there. The most concentrated group of immigrant children are around Hyde Park, and they're the children of Americans, they're bankers. That is statistically from the census the most concentrated set of overseas born kids. Majority of schools in Kensington and Chelsea are private, majority of hospitals are private. It's partly an immigrant effect. If you want to see a city utterly altered, I wouldn't say I'm happy with it. Imagine growing up in a city where all your friends have to leave, when almost none of your children have a chance of being able to stay, where the average house price is 17 times the average income, when really arrogant people keep on arriving thinking they're brilliant with their strange accents and treating the locals like servants who clean after them, clean their bedrooms. Right, you might get annoyed about immigrants. We have a city like that. It's called Oxford. When I do public talks in Oxford, the first thing I do is ask people to put up their hand if they're born in Oxfordshire. And then I welcome all the immigrants to the city I was born in. It's not the end of the world. But we talk about problems of immigration as being 200 Roma arriving in S8 in Sheffield. It's just, we've got to get on for questions because you can see I can get wound up. Manufacturing. We've managed to get it down to 10% of our economy. Quite an achievement to get it that, you know, what do you think they're going to buy? What are we going to do these trade deals of apart from weapons? The British government says that we're the second biggest arms dealer in the world. Actually, turns out we're the sixth. This comes to something when your government's trying to claim you a bigger arms dealer than they actually are. In the town I grew up in Oxford, when I was a child, there were 40,000 car workers making minis, all with families. There are now 3,000, mostly younger men without families, half of whom come from Eastern Europe, and are living many to a house. The minis are mostly made by robots, 1,200 robots. It's beautiful, you can go and watch it. It's much better than the old factory. My dad took me to the factory to tell me to work hard at school. Just the noise was enough to make you want to work hard at school. 1,200 robots, 3,000 men, some women finally, makes 1% of our manufacturing output of Britain. One car factory in Oxford. That's how little we're now making. The car factory normally closes down for 2 weeks in summer so they can clean it and fix the robots. They brought the closure of the car factory forward to the 29th of March this year. Why are there 1,200 robots? Because they don't want to build a robot bigger than the back of an articulated lorry. Because you can move the BMW factory from Oxford in about 2 weeks to the Czech border, if you have to. Why are they in Oxford? They're in Oxford for the name, Minis Made in Oxford. And with the fact in Germany it would be illegal to make men work for 7 hours and 20 minutes with only one toilet break, which is what you can do in Oxford and you can't do in Germany. If anybody wants a big argument about trade and Empire 2.0 in future, this is the slide about it. But just to say, India doesn't buy much from us. Not because they don't understand about our wonderful products, but because there are other places you can now buy whatever it is, your £6 billion worth of goods a year. We buy far more, of course, from India. What are the great inventions of Britain recently? How wonderful is a hairdryer which works with a kind of special circular thing that you might buy somebody for Christmas? Or a vacuum cleaner or a hand dryer or whatever else James came up with and is actually manufactured in Malaysia. Right? And you can come up with something other than Mr. Dyson's amazing inventions later, but believe me, we're not going to do Empire 2.0 on the back of James Dyson. Although James Dyson, remarkably, is very keen about Empire 2.0. Why have the negotiations been so tricky? Standard & Poor produced this graph about 3 weeks before the referendum. And it's the graph of the countries which are most affected by Brexit, other than the UK. And they got it remarkably right. They said the most affected country will be Ireland. Okay, and that's obvious. And then Malta, and then Luxembourg, and then Cyprus, and then Switzerland, and then Belgium. Why does that matter? Because they're all really small, and they're not much affected. So we've had some poor civil servants sitting in Brussels, around a table, negotiating with people who are sitting there in France and Germany, going, and? you know, they're not going, oh, we really, really like minis. You know, we're going to have a special deal with you so we can still get the mini coming over. That is the brutal truth of it. There's been a game played on the mainland of don't be the first mainland country to point out to the British what is obvious to everybody else. It's really embarrassing. It's really very, very embarrassing. If the seas were absolutely full of fish, you know, then maybe, but they're not. And we're still arguing about can we, you know, fish the very last ones of the poor mites so that we can really make sure that the fish, that it doesn't, they don't work. It is just remarkable. It is truly remarkable what has been going on. I had a political journalist come over from Amsterdam about a month ago, and she came and sat at the kind of posh table at an Oxford college, and we were talking about Article 50, and she's a political journalist. And she said, what's Article 50? Yeah. Because it's not an issue. It's not actually that important on the mainland. If it was, we would have a very different kind of deal. What do we do other than take disproportionate numbers of their young people, like some kind of Pied Piper of Hamlet, and take the more, you know, less clever ones and charge them enormous fees to do our master's courses because they can't work out they can actually do them for free at home? Germany has 330,000 overseas students. Do you know how much they pay in fees? Zero. And even after Brexit, if any of you fancy, you know, going off and doing a master's course or PhD, or your children want to do a degree, is it worth £56,000 or £70,000 to learn German? They'll still take you, because they want their universities to be interesting. 330,000 is more than the overseas students that we take. And this is, maybe this explains why I get really annoyed. When I was born in 1968, the best place to be born in the world was Oxford. We had the first baby incubators in the John Radcliffe. We had the lowest infant mortality rate. Right, it's very good news if you're a baby. By 1990, we were seventh in Europe, neonatal mortality rate. Not bad. 2015, we dropped down, I think, to 19th. A little bit embarrassing, really. Since 2015, for the first time since the Second World War, for 3 years in a row now, infant mortality in this country has risen. Up again, more grieving parents again. Nowhere else in Europe is it rising. Whose babies are dying? It's not the immigrants. It's the English-born mothers who are dying. When are the babies dying? They're dying around about the time of birth or the first couple of days. There's time when you need the health service. Where do a third of midwives in London come from? From the EU, but not the UK. When, would you be a midwife in London, given what they're paid? And London vents, the only way we manage to keep the health service going in the south is by the enthusiasm of people who grew up in much more equal and very, very nice, but a little bit boring places. And we can get them to come over here for a year. The John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford only survives on people coming for 6 month or 1 year contracts because the pay is less than their rent. But they can put Oxford on the CV and we can keep a hospital going. A month ago, we have 6 maternity units. This is Oxfordshire. On the Thursday night a month ago, 5 of the units closed their doors. All home births were cancelled with no notice. All the midwives were ordered to come to the central hospital, and every woman giving birth was told to find a way to get there. If you were in Chipping Norton, right, and it's worse in other parts of the country, by the way, but the point is Oxford. If you were in Chipping Norton, you had to check Facebook to see if the maternity unit was open if you went into labour. And if you went into labour at around about 6 o'clock in the morning, you had to somehow drive yourself to the John Radcliffe. And if any of you know what the traffic's like, and we had somebody gave birth, thankfully successfully, on the A34 2 weeks ago, on the hard shoulder. The red line is the age sex adjusted mortality rate for the country, which, like all countries in the world, has been going down for decade after decade after decade, and then bang, you get this at the end. Our life expectancy peaked in 2014 for men and women. It's been lower ever since. Nowhere else in Europe. What did the government say in 2014? It's the flu. What they say in 2015, it's definitely the flu. 2016, it's the flu. 2017, it's the flu. Special kind of flu that kind of restricts itself to national borders. They finally stop saying it's the flu now. But we have falling life expectancy. The figures are going to be released in a couple of weeks by area. Given that you have falling life expectancy on average for the whole country, once you get the figures for each area, you're going to see quite dramatic things going on. Life expectancy doesn't fall at the moment. And you might say, oh, we can't carry on rising forever. But it can rise for quite a bit if you're in the very bottom of the table of OECD countries. You know, we're not that good at it. What does Matt Hancock say, the health secretary now? He says, oh, it's drinking, it's smoking, it's obesity. Smoking rates, falling. Drinking rates are falling. Obesity has risen for the age group who are not dying. Because the increase in deaths is amongst the elderly. The most frail, people with dementia and Alzheimer's who are most in need of care, and the babies. And if you're trying to understand the anger of things, an idea that, you know, we have a country that is falling apart. This is what a country that's falling apart is like. We're just very good at having a stiff upper lip and getting used to it. It is hard to think how much worse you would have to get it. Remarkable things happening. These are swings, the conventional measure of swings, the East General Election since 1945. 1945 was a landslide. The next landslide for Labour didn't occur until 1997. That was after 18 years of Conservative rule. Tony Blair did okay. But then Tony Blair led the Labour Party again in 2001 and had a negative swing. Again in 2005 and a negative swing. Gordon Brown, poor man, had to wait too long. Stood as Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party after that huge financial crash. Imagine getting an even bigger negative swing than Tony Blair had got. Ed Miliband then stands and does brilliantly. 1.4% positive swing. Really, really good. Just going to take a lot of elections to actually win. And then, June 2017, 9.6% swing in 2 years. Not in 10 years, not 1935 to 45, in 2 years, without a war. By a man who can't speak in public very well and says he doesn't really want to be Prime Minister, whose party was in absolute disarray and hoping he would lose. Let's skip that one. I showed you the swirly graph before, but this is a kind of remarkable thing that's happening after Brexit. That loop is the rise in support for the Labour Party in late April, May and June of last year. I've drawn 2,000 of these graphs because I'm a very sad man. And believe you me, for no political party at no point since we have polled anything in this country has this ever happened before. We have never had a faster, larger swing and change in political opinion ever, which means we can no longer say what will happen, because we always say what can happen on the basis of what's happened in the past. Then we go, we're very clever, we're experts. It's very hard to be an expert when unpredictable things actually begin to happen. The Bank of England no longer produce their fan diagram of error, because the last time they did it, the thing crashed out of every error bar that they did. So we don't know what can happen. People might say, if you look at all the other ones, after each large vote for Labour, it drops again. But all the other ones, they actually formed a government. And whenever you form a government, you don't actually deliver the land and milk and honey that you promised. People get a bit annoyed. The vote goes against you. The really interesting thing about 2017 is that Labour didn't form a government. So there's no disappointment with what they've done in government because they haven't been in government. You can have lots of disappointment with them. The really clever thing would be to get yourself another leader, preferably 6 months before an election, preferably aged about 30, 35, and preferably female. I'll go for any MP that fits that profile. But you could do it again. You could have that swing again because there are huge numbers of people who don't normally vote and lots of young people who are just about learning to vote. We've got to accept we're odd, I think. And we need to accept and learn these things fast, because what happens in the next few months is going to be very important, very interesting, and probably very tricky. People are going to start shouting words like traitor around. It's going to get a bit nasty. Whatever happens, somebody's going to be blamed. Lots of people are going to be blamed. Most Europeans know how to protest. This slide was made some time ago, not because of what they're doing in France at the moment, but they do know how to protest. The second worst country in the world, in Europe, for protesting, maybe the world actually, might be India, is Germany. Only 30% of Germans have been on a protest. But that's double the number of people in Britain. We are remarkably well behaved. It's amazing what we will take and what we will allow to happen before we can even be bothered to take a panel and walk down the street, let alone, you know, get angry in other ways. Personally, I think this behaviour could be very good, because depending on what happens, a propensity for queuing and kind of doing what you're told and taking orders could be useful. My nightmare scenario, I don't think we're going to get to a hard Brexit, but the plans for a hard Brexit have already been made. Thousands of civil servants have been moved out of their departments. The food dumps have been identified. My personal preference for hard Brexit is that we have a form of rationing which is disproportionate, so that I'm looking at the thinner members, you sir, you would get the full calories for a year, but I would be on two-thirds rationed, and we could go in a year from the fattest country of Europe to the anyway, silver linings of a hard Brexit, if we could do it. And I don't know whether I should end with this image, but this is the last image. And you don't have to say anything about this image, but if it had happened a few years earlier, I don't think it would have been the same kind of thing. The fact that it happened after that election, the fact it happened after the banking crisis, we're actually changing. We're changing our attitudes about what we think is right, what we think is fair. We are incredibly divided. Really, really divided. Except we're ever so politely divided. So we'll see if we can get a bit fractious in questions. We're very confused. This wasn't supposed to happen. You weren't supposed to have the governor of the Bank of England saying, house prices could fall 30% in the next 6 months. Who's going to buy a house before the 29th of March, when Mark Carney has said they could fall 30%? No. If you were thinking of just getting out a mortgage now, you know, unless you want to be the negative equity winner of the country, would you buy a flat in London for £800,000 now? Or would you just wait? What happens if everybody waits? We've almost set this thing up for what's going on. I think that it's fascinating. I think it's frightening. I think it's telling us a lot about ourselves that I really don't think hardly anybody knew. I think it's going to be challenging, in that to get through it is going to require a degree of talking to each other and understanding each other and sympathy that we have not had for a long time, because we ordered our society in a way that was good for being in charge of other people, but where you don't meet the eyes of the person above you and you don't care too much about the people below you. And that isn't going to work for the next 12 months. The number of people who've died on the streets, homeless, has increased 10 times in the last 5 years. Now, when that kind of thing begins to happen, and when it happens that fast, when the shock's that big, you can tell it's not going to be the same. In a year from now, it will not be the same. But we can handle it better or well, or we can handle it badly. One last thing, just to give you some optimism. The nearest equivalent to this is Suez, much smaller, and most of you won't even know what Suez is. I mean, I wasn't there. My mum told me about Suez. It was an embarrassment. It wasn't many years after the national embarrassment of Suez that we had the 1960s. And we allowed people to read a book called Lady Chatterley's Lover. and we didn't think that was a bad thing. And we had the Beatles, and we had different clothes, and things were looking up again. This isn't necessarily doom and gloom for a very long time, but it's belt tightening, I think, irrespective of whatever else happens, for at least 5 or 6 years. The important thing is to come out of it a better and nicer and more tolerant place than the country that we had become. A country in which a majority of people were happy to vote for anything but this, with no idea really what it was going to be, because anything but this was better than Remain. Thank you very much.
We will have questions in a couple of minutes once I have turned on all the...
Please, if you have any questions, put your hands up. We'll start here.
Would you agree that lack of immigration in some areas of England and Scotland and Wales has been a major contributor to rising social tensions between the two? And it's been kind of exploited by politicians?
Okay. Lack of immigration?
Yes, lack of immigration as a cause of more tensions.
Of not getting enough immigration?
Yeah.
Scotland's different. So Scotland has a social solidarity helped by London being so mean to Scotland and so on, which is partly why Scotland voted Remain so much. So Scotland has quite a lot of immigration. Both Scotland and Wales want more immigration, the governments. One of the nicest things I saw from the Welsh government was the suggestion that anybody from the world should be allowed into Wales as long as you learn Welsh up to a certain level first. I think it's a great incentive kind of test. The areas which haven't had immigrants have greater intolerance and fear. But that isn't because of the lack of immigrants, it's because of the reason why the immigrants don't come. And the problem is the places where you don't get immigrants are places not worth going to, put it very bluntly. And if you live somewhere that it isn't worth other people turning up to, there are reasons for that. And you see elsewhere people doing very well. And your young people go. They go to university and they never come back. And the more successful young people go. And that's been going on for some time in Britain. So we have the biggest regional divides in Europe. We have the biggest concentrations of poverty in Western Europe. We allow areas to die. We don't clear villages. We did think of doing it in County Durham at one point. They were called the D villages. So we don't have Detroits. But we allow areas to shrink, become smaller, become less economically viable. I was talking to a firefighter this lunchtime from Blythe, and I said to Blythe up on the Northumbrian coast, and I said, oh, you've got the power station. And she went, no, the power station isn't there anymore. So I said, so what are you doing in Blythe? And she kind of looked at me, like, well, I work in a fire station. And we allow that to happen. And other places don't. And then we call it globalisation, which is completely wrong, because other countries in Europe, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, even Germany, don't allow places to die and people to be dispossessed in the same kind of way.
You mentioned about the lack of protest. Do you think also the lack of political engagement in the UK, coupled with a very right-wing, pretty rabid press, and you mentioned the rise of UKIP, and they had the slogan, take back control. I was at my brother's and I went to the Liberal Party a few days before the vote. So a man and a woman, everybody was voting Brexit, and they all came out with take back control. But when you started a discussion about Europe, aspects of Europe, the lack of understanding was quite telling.
Yeah, I agree. But people are right that they didn't have control. You know, control had been lost in general. It wasn't just the control of people over what happens in your area, in your community. The British government hadn't had control of events in the way that the British government in the past. You know, I mean, if you want to go back a long way, after we lost the 13 colonies, those terrorists who took that country that's now called the United States, after that occurred, we became really tough. And we made sure that we didn't lose another colony. And we took control. And we took control of the world, the largest part of the world. And to go from that attitude and mentality, the stories of how we stood alone in Europe and so on, to what we are now, it's really hard to come down from that position. There are very few examples in the world. The United Provinces were the richest place before us. House prices fell in Amsterdam in real terms for 250 years. I often tell that to people in London. 250 years in real terms. It's really hard, I think, when you've been at the centre of something like that, to become normal. And for 200 years, we have not actually had to pay our way. And that's one of our big problems. And we still don't want to pay our way. Jacob Rees-Mogg's father, his last book, it's called Sovereign Something. He was the editor of the Times. His last book was about how Britain can become the financial centre of the globe again, which in other words is making money without making anything. We will just be the centre of banking. And the way to become the centre of banking in the world is to get out of the European Union so there are no controls, and essentially we'll become a giant Cayman Islands. And if you wonder what drives Jacob Rees-Mogg, just read his dad's last book. If my dad wrote a book, I like my dad, you know, I would care about it. And if my dad then died, you know, I would try and help get what my dad wanted. So we're still trying to be the richest people in the world without having to work hard. George Osborne, 2015, TV interview, said, if you follow my economic plan, by 2030, we will be the richest large country in the world. This obsession with being number one again, is still absolutely there. Take back control, be great again. Revive our destiny.
But it's just a slogan, but very clever slogan.
No, it's more
short
than
time,
just... It's more than a slogan. Matthew Elliott, Leeds Boys Private School. I go through them all. Matthew Elliott and Dominic Cummings, slightly more expensive private school in Durham. Now they thought about it up carefully, and it's more than just a slogan. Me and Sally go into ridiculous kind of, you might well think even fantasies about this in the book about control and about the British. William Beveridge, who helped make the welfare state, wrote a book a few years before the 1942 pamphlet saying that all middle class people should have four children for the good of the British race, for the good of the world. Now, why did William Beveridge think that the world needed the British race, particularly British genes? We've never had to examine his ideas because we've never lost a war and been pilloried. Well, what was the most powerful country in the world when The Origins of Species, with the subtitle about the favoured races, was published? And you suddenly go from a world where people believe that everything was created and ordained by God to a world where you believe that it's survival of the fittest and natural selection, and who's at the top? So we develop theories where we, I mean, people at the top of British society, I am in the heart of where it happened. I work at Oxford University. This is where Darwin debated with the bishop about it. It's a very comfortable theory to say, why are we controlling the largest empire in the world? Because we are the superior race. And only by being held back by these Europeans are we not fulfilling our true destiny. Well, we must be superior. We invented everything. Now, if you go to the Industrial Museum in Paris, you'll discover that actually somebody else, at exactly the same time, you know, invented. All inventions are copied. They're never actually made by a single person. And all of these things are tricky. and that when they, this myth is particularly held by the children of the richest families in Britain. How else do you justify spending £30,000 on a child's education a year, unless there's something very special in that child, and it requires really dedicated teaching to bring out the special ability of the special boys who were at that school in Eton because their name's put down at birth because their father went there? Why would you have a system of father to son, unless there's something inherently special in them and they're born to rule and everything will be good, and most of you, most of us, we're not clever enough to understand it.
Thank you, Vicar.
Thank you for a stimulating lecture, Mr. Darling, but I must protest your lecture, I'm afraid. Frankly, I find it astonishing that intelligent people can listen to what you say and take a lot of it seriously. I mean, I recently, about 3 weeks ago, I was in Iceland. Now, Icelandic people are not too keen at the moment on joining the EU. Is this because they're all racists dreaming of the imperial past? I don't think so, you know. You said that Daniel Hannan, the Conservative MEP, was on the far right. I mean, I'm sure many people have watched the debates around Brexit. You know, this guy's a classical liberal. How can you say that he's on the far right? It's just astonishing.
Okay, let me answer that. Then you can ask another question, don't worry, because this makes it much more fun. Because it's lovely if we all agree, but it's much more fun if we don't. And the country doesn't agree. And the problem about doing talks like this is everybody agrees too much, too often. Just on the far right thing, you can line all the MEPs up by the groups that they're in. They're not all in groups of both. And you've got some far left groups and some green groups, and you've got a little liberal group, and you've got the big Social Democrat Labour group, and you've got the big EPP group. And then you've got a couple of really tiny groups to the far right, and I'm just calling them far right because they're to the far right. I'm very spatial, I'm a geographer. And he's in one of those groups. In fact, I think he leads one of those groups. That's why.
Okay, but I mean, my serious point would be, you know, this is the Institute of Applied Ethics, and don't you think you have an ethical duty as a teacher to sort of step outside of your ideological prison? I mean, your students, you know, are getting a very one-sided view of the world. And one thing that we surely need in today's British society is to understand each other. We're a divided society because of Brexit. We need to actually talk to each other and engage seriously with each other's ideas, not just have a one-sided monoculture. And that's what I'm worried about in the universities.
But you'll get that from one speaker. We can supply you other people. We have Professor Christian Bigger, if you want. Oxford's very good at the other side. A disproportionate number of my students would agree with you. A disproportionate number of my students have gone to very expensive public schools and are very, very keen about Brexit. So when I talk, I mean, one lucky thing about being at Oxford is I get to talk to the children of the elite who believe they should be in charge of the world. And believe me, I am not changing their opinions. When I say, you know, do you really want to be in a Bullingdon club? They go, oh, yes, yes, yes. And I say, you know, it might hurt your CV later in life. And they go, no, it'll really help. But I can't be a schizophrenic person with many different views. I'd love to have the ability to put on a hat and to actually try and play you straight the Nigel Farage argument. I mean, that'd be really hard. I'd love to be able to do it, but I'm not a good enough actor to be able to do it. So I have to tell you honestly what I think the case is, having looked at it. And I could easily be wrong, and I certainly will be wrong about many things. I mean, that's one thing you can be sure about. We're only going to discover the truth of all of this in some decades from now. I think we can look back at Suez and say, you know, that particular incident, we've got a fairly good idea about what happened, what the Americans allowed, what we did with the French, what the Egyptians have done. We tend to agree on things in the past. We're going to be arguing about this one for some time to come. But thank you.
I'm conscious that we have a number of people waiting. So can I ask that the questions get short and the answers are succinct?
I've got a very easy microphone.
I think I can shout, so people at the back.
Hello. 40 years ago, we had the biggest fishing industry in the world, in Hull. Joining the European community closed that down. Do you think, and threw Hull into a terminal decline in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, do you think leaving the European community will give us our fishing industry back?
I am not an expert on fishing. It has to accept, well, a key part of the fishing industry is the processing and the actual selling it. And the difficulty is if we can't actually send fish to the market in the mainland, you know, what do you, I mean, I guess we can all eat more fish ourselves, but it's tricky. There's a limited amount of fish out there. And that's the most important thing about fishing is the ecological stuff about making sure you get bigger fish stocks in future. And I think that's part of the argument about it. The other interesting thing about fishing is the point about Iceland. You know, what I really hope we don't get to, which we did back in the 70s, is little gunboats circling around and landing somebody on a rock called Rockall. If you look at the 1971 census, it has this tiny rock in the middle of nowhere where we claim that a family were living because we took a ship and we landed them. And then we sent another ship with a census form and they filled it in. The tricky thing is, how on earth have we got to a point when on the edge of a continental shelf, a set of countries cannot work out what kind of fishing it makes sense to happen or not happen? And these are some of the most developed, advanced countries on the planet. And we're still arguing about something as simple as taking fish out of an ocean and whether you dredge from the bottom and so on. That's my big worry, is that that should be one of the easier things to solve. And the fact we haven't managed to solve it is tricky. And even with Short, I won't mention Michael Gove's parents.
Thank you. At the beginning of your talk, you said something along the lines of no one was predicting that Brexit would happen. So I'd like to ask you now to make some kind of prediction. You don't have to write it down. But what you think may happen, I know you're talking about huge unpredictability and everything, but what do you think may happen politically in this country over, let's say, the next 5 years in terms of governments and...
Okay.
How are things going? What's your
prediction? Maybe it can really be wrong, but Theresa loses the vote on the 11th of December. She then goes into emergency negotiations with Barnier. That takes us just before Christmas. They come out with an agreement. I suspect it's already been agreed before. And there's been a slight move on the behalf of the EU27. MPs are recalled slightly early just to really, really annoy them, because they like their holidays. That fails again. We enter the point of January the 25th when there has to be votes, and the votes every 5 days. It gets more and more catastrophic. People begin to report the house prices falling. They begin to report the banking shares. The banks get... Project Fear gets bigger and bigger. The people who think it's Project Fear just go, it's even worse. The elites are taking over, they're doing Project Fear. And then my prediction is, in March, there's so many things. In March, she revokes Article 50. If I had to bet, and you heard it here. If it doesn't happen, you didn't hear anything. she revokes Article 50, and she does a speech in Parliament. She says, "I've got four. I'm dying of numerous things. I've had 2 hours sleep a night for the last 2 years. I've read every document. I love my country. Believe in my country above everything else. For the good of my country, I have sent a letter to Brussels." She could do it on her own. Doesn't have to ask the cabinet. And then we get a kind of peaceful civil war breaks out, and the Tory party split into two parties like Labour and the SDP did. This might be my wishful thinking. But that Theresa is a Remainer, a circle around her Remainers. Her husband works in the finance industry. They are in big, big trouble if things are not. And the best thing that can happen for the British finance industry, not necessarily for us, but for the financiers, is actually revoking Article 50, which can be done at any point up to about 10 o'clock on the night of the 29th of March.
That's 5 months. You're asked 5 years.
5 years very quickly. We get to Labour SNP coalition. Labour SNP. We have a different. Jeremy Corbyn has a small stroke here, but hopefully very, very small. Hopefully one that didn't really happen.
Stroke of luck.
Stroke of luck. Labour elect their second deputy leader. That's one they're supposed to be doing. It has to be from an all-women shortlist. They elect their second deputy leader. In effect, they're electing Jeremy Corbyn's replacement. She becomes prime minister in coalition with Nicola. And you have two women running the country after one older woman ran the country as a coalition. And that government lasts for 5 years.
Thank you. I look forward to that. There you go. Yeah. Really?
A phenomenon that I noticed you did not bring up, which often gets pointed out in relation to Brexit and surrounding issues, is that of London centrism, both of the economy and the national press and other media. When you showed the graph of where immigrants are going and ethnicity in terms of foreign born, you showed that most of the country wasn't really affected. It was all really in the Greater London area, and also that fear of immigration was a major driver behind Brexit. Do you think that London-based journalism has perhaps given the rest of the country misleading impressions of the UK's demography?
Yes, I think it's terrible we don't have The Guardian in Manchester anymore. It's terrible we don't have local papers with reporters aged over 25 anymore, and it's a real problem. But it also relates back to empire. The three largest cities in Europe are all the dead heart stars of former empires. Istanbul, heart of the Ottoman Empire, it's enormous. Moscow, heart of the USSR. I mean, if you want to know about an empire falling apart, look at 1989-1991 in Russia. That's what we want to avoid. And London, the heart of an empire. So the dominance is far too big. But the belief that if London's okay, everybody else is okay. So we build Crossrail, and do everything for the capital. And then you can get trickle down elsewhere. It's a terrible centralised belief. Oxford basically is the borough of London now. We have two train lines to London. It takes 50 minutes to get to London. Cambridge is a borough of London. Everything is orientated around the capital. I want Parliament to move out because it's going to cost so much to rebuild it. Just above the Y of the High Speed 2 intersection to the east of Birmingham. Everywhere can get there within 30 minutes. Build Parliament just above there and turn Parliament and all the civil service buildings into hotels for tourists. Because the one thing that's going to boom as the pound keeps on dropping is tourism. We're going to get a hell of a lot of tourists. And one great benefit of having been a former empire is we've built an enormous number of relatively old buildings on the back of the empire. Almost every building in my university is built from money from empire. Some of the oldest libraries are built from slave plantation money from Barbados. But we can become a bigger tourist attraction. And they're already doing it. I mean, look at how wholesales itself. You may not want to be a tourist attraction, but in the short term, we're going to need cash. And we're going to have more tourists. The tricky thing is that we've been using cheap labour from Europe. If you go to Alton Towers and see who's working in Alton Towers, the locals have found themselves nicer jobs than looking after a roller coaster all day. So Alton Towers is going to have to be operated by British people for the first time. So I wouldn't necessarily go on the roller coasters for a bit.
Okay, I apologise to those of you who still have questions. I think we've reached the end of our time. A lot of us have lots to think about, not least those of us who are in the middle of buying a house.
But before a third of the value of my house gets wiped out, anyway, please, can we close by thanking Professor Dawn for a very good